Have you noticed how fast the cost of food is climbing? That apple that was only 29 cents a pound just a few years ago, and then it was 49 cents, has jumped up to $1.49 a pound. Why? Because that apple is not locally grown. It came from Chile. On today's show, we talk to the author of the book, The Town That Food Saved.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seed? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows from the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Ben Hewitt lives in small town, northern Vermont. He purchased 40 acres, built a cabin home where he and his wife and two children lived, off the grid. No electricity. And the heat, obviously, would. After a small while, he managed to buy solar panels. He mounted them high off the ground because Vermont gets a lot of snow. So he made sure the bottom of these solar panels was at least 6 feet. And in January and February, where the sun isn't that strong, he made up for that loss of electricity by building a windmill. A windmill that turns 360 degrees so that it's able to make electricity all the time. So the combination of the two of them suits Ben and his family just fine. Today we talk to Ben Hewitt. Buster, all mixed up in one, to waste another breath. To go ahead and first talk about why you decided to build your own house, or why you decided to do that.
Yeah, so, why we decided to build a house. Initially, I would say it was for economics. I mean, I grew up in working class Vermont. I was raised by working class parents, and have never really had the sort of income that would really have allowed us to do much different. Building our own house was a way that we could create a home that didn't force us to go into a lot of debt.
Is that because of the heating and electricity?
You mean debt-wise?
Yeah, I mean, was the debt just because houses are expensive, or were you thinking...
Just because houses are expensive. I mean, we were looking for... we wanted a big enough piece of land that we could do a little bit of agriculture. So we spent, basically all of our savings on the land itself. Mm-hmm. We have 40 acres. At that point, we were pretty much flat broke. And so we borrowed $10,000 from a friend and built basically a cabin with that and lived in that for many years, and then slowly built off of that as we could afford to.
Now, when you built the cabin, did it have electricity? Did it have heat?
No, we have never had at least grid electricity. We have had solar power. Originally, we had nothing for a period of time, and then we purchased a generator, a gasoline power generator, and would charge up batteries with that so we could run like a radio and so a couple of lights, and I could run my laptop computer. And then we slowly built up sort of larger scale solar photovoltaic system.
Did you install it yourself?
We installed it with a friend of ours. We were fortunate to have a old high school friend of mine is in the business of doing alternative energy installations, and he helped us.
Right, so you wanted to stay off grid, so you did solar on the roof?
It's actually on its own separate rack, basically, that's about, 80 feet from the house.
Really? That's different. Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, the roof makes it very challenging. In a snowy climate, like you probably have up there also, it's really challenging when it's on the roof because it's hard to get to. Of course, when the snow covers it, it's not making any power. And if you're off-grid, you're really relying on, particularly in the winter when the days are short and there's not as much sun, you really want every last bit of power you can get out of it. And so it's really essential to have it in a place that you can access pretty easily to wipe snow off it, clean snow off it.
So you're saying the solar panels were installed how far away from the cabin?
Oh, they're currently about 80 feet from our house.
80
when,
feet.
When they were on the cabin, there was a little bit of a different system, and they were actually installed right on the side of the cabin. But that was many years ago now.
Okay, so initially they were on the side of the cabin.
That's correct.
Then you moved it away from the cabin. All right. Now, how did you still beat the snow, even if the solar panels were put 80 feet from the house? How did you raise them up and keep them
They're on a big pole. So there's a big, basically, pole coming out of the ground. It looks like it's metal, but it looks like it's about the same diameter as a telephone pole. And then there is a rack, basically, that mounts to that pole, and the panels are bolted to that rack.
Okay, so it's impervious to snow unless it's how many feet deep?
No, the bottom of the panels are about 6 feet off the ground.
Okay, 6 feet and higher?
If we get 6 feet of snow, we're in trouble in way more ways than that, so...
Yes, the cabin may fall down.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to know is, you said something about wind power?
That's right. We have a windmill on our property.
Right. And so after the solar, why did you use the windmill power as well?
Because in the winter, you run into a situation where the days are shorter, obviously, and there's much less sunshine. But sort of conveniently enough, I guess, at the same time, December, January, February, which are the most challenging months for solar power, are also the best months for wind in Vermont. It's a very nice companion power source to solar photovoltaics.
That's very interesting.
I mean, we live on a ridge top, so our farm is kind of it's on a slope, and we're the top of it where the windmill is located is right at the sort of height of the land.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a pretty good location for wind, and really what direction is coming from doesn't really matter because the windmill rotates to catch the wind, and it can rotate 360 degrees. So
that's amazing. So is there a company name that you got these windmills from, just for anybody?
The windmill is from a company called Southwest Wind Power.
Personally curious. I live in an apartment building, and I'm always thinking, how can we make it? Which way do we have to face? So you write part-time?
Yes, I would say. I mean, it's really the mainstay of our income, but it's, I probably spend about, on average, 30 hours a week at my desk, and another, on average, 20 or so hours a week, engaged in the farm.
What kind of farm is it?
We run a diversified vegetable, dairy, meat operation, and berries actually. And I sort of describe it to people as a sort of a turn of the century subsistence farm. And when I'm talking about turn of the century, I don't mean like the most recent turn of the century. I'm thinking more along the lines of the early 1900s. So everything is done in very small scale and sort of symbiotically. Our first priority is to raise and provide as much of our family's food as possible, and then when we have excess, we look into the community to sell that.
Okay, you have a family of four, so...
That's correct.
So how did you figure out what you need on your farm to make sure you guys get through the year?
Oh, that's a good question. How did we figure out what we need on our farm to make... there was never any sort of... conscientious sort of calculation. It's like we decided we wanted to get produce our own dairy. We bought a milk cow, and we started milking, and quickly realized that one cow is more than enough for a family of four, and that we could sell the excess. The gardens, we have extensive gardens. My wife has a lot of experience with vegetable farming, so she has made those calculations over the years to know, how many rows of spinach do we need, for instance, if we want to put up enough spinach for the winter, or how many rows of green beans or whatever. And so we sort of let, one thing about having, sort of only, I say only kind of in quotation marks, because, 40 acres is actually a very, very luxuriant piece of land to have.
But a lot of land, yeah.
It is a lot of land. But in terms of farming, and at least the way people tend to farm in rural America, it's in probably rural Canada, it's not that much land. And so it sort of limits you in terms of, the scale and scope of what you can do. And part of, 30 acres of our 40 is woodland, which is, not, we do get our firewood and do some maple syrup production, but it's not really appropriate for crops or for grazing animals. So we are sort of limited by the piece of land that we're on.
So you're limited not only because of the woods that are on the land, but you were talking about soil?
Soil is always a huge issue. I think everyone is probably, very few people probably in modern North America, modern day North America, are dealing with anything but soils that have been depleted. Right. So I think everyone is, you know, deals with soil limitations. And, you know, we work very hard to try to increase the fertility and productivity of our soils. But I think, you know, those limitations are definitely there.
So you're saying or suggesting that everywhere the soil is already depleted.
I think, you know, I would not want to say everywhere, but because I certainly don't have a personal experience with every, you know, every acre of soil throughout mm-hmm. North America. But, right. you know, clearly soil fertility and mineralization is a huge issue and tremendous limiting factor in agricultural production.
So when you say mineralization, what do you mean by that?
Well, most soils nowadays have been demineralized over the years. I'm talking about like trace minerals, phosphorus and calcium and whatnot. Then most soils have been demineralized over the years by extensive ag production or just simply time. They will erode and demineralize.
To stop the erosion of those minerals, what has to be done?
Well, you have to add trace minerals back into your soils.
You have to add it. I would thinking just rotation on a regular basis.
Well, rotation can help with the development of humus and topsoil, but it doesn't really generally add that. You know, the minerals themselves are often, and one of the reasons that this area is actually a pretty productive agricultural area, even though it is, you know, we've got long, hard winters, is that we have really good, in general, really pretty good soils because it's of the bedrock here. So a lot of those minerals actually come from the bedrock that's underneath the soil. But over time that is sort of is leached out or farmed out of it, so to speak, and you have to add something back.
Okay, so you're actually just working 10 acres and you have to feed it the missing minerals.
That's correct.
So that's the calculations you've figured out and you're doing for your working farm, which you say, how many hours a week do you work the farm?
Oh, I work on it. You know, it's really hard to say because it's a lot different this time of year than it is in the middle of summer when we have a lot more going on. But I think it's an average of about 20 hours a week. And my wife probably is more of an average of about 30 hours a week.
Okay, so it's done by the two of you. That helps.
That's correct.
Okay, so what brought you to write the book to get to the point where you wanted to publish a book that talked about food and how food can save your local city? First, let's talk about your local town, town, how far away it is from you and how you wanted to think about feeding them as well and the size of it.
So I actually live in the town of Cabot. So the book is actually about Hardwick, which is a town about 8 miles east of my hometown of Cabot. So
the book is about Hardwick, right?
That's correct.
So why did you choose Hardwick over your other small town?
Well, because Hardwick, for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, Hardwick is a larger community. It's about 3,200 people.
Okay.
And Hardwick has kind of been a town that has had a really hard time economically for many, many decades. So it's been sort of one of those towns. It's got high unemployment. It's got low median income. And about 5 years ago or so, I started noticing that there were an awful lot of small-scale ag-based business startups in the town of Hardwick.
Because they were hard-pressed for buying food?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say because there was a lot of relatively inexpensive land. There was basically some opportunity there, I think.
Okay.
There was also sort of a history. I mean, the town has been an agricultural town for a long time. I mean, of course, every town in North America or even around the world was an agricultural town at one point, not so long ago. But Hardwick never got as far away from that as most communities did. So there was sort of this, sort of ethos, if you will, of agriculture, you know, in the area. And there was also a lot of pretty agreeably priced land. Because it was an economically challenged town, the property values never really got out of control like they did in so many places.
What happened to that town? What happened to make it become desperate and to the point you're talking about?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that sort of happened was in the early 1900s, it was actually a really booming granite town. So it was one of the largest granite company that operated in the town was actually the largest producer of building-grade granite in the world. And Hardwick was actually really hopping. There was a lot of immigrant laborers working in the granite quarries, and it was a very vibrant town. And then in the 1920s, reinforced concrete was invented, And that really put a huge dent in the granite industry, because no longer did they have to ship these huge blocks of granite across the country to build these buildings on, because now they could just pour concrete from all the individual components on site, which was a lot easier.
Right.
And so that really sort of set the stage for the sort of initial decline in the area. And, you know, right after that came the Great Depression. So this was in, like, the late 1920s. And then, of course, in the early 30s, the Great Depression came. And it just sort of seemed like the town kind of, you know, it's very rural. It's a long way away from any other sort of significant economic centers. And it just never really found another industry. I think, like a lot of rural towns in America and probably in Canada, never really found another industry that could sort of support its local working population.
Right. But here in southwestern Ontario, everything's dependent on a major freeway and the car.
Right. And there's nothing, you know, Hardwick is almost an hour away from the nearest freeway.
That helps.
So there's no quick road to get to another sort of center of industry, if you know what I'm saying.
And it's not plausible to make a highway around?
Well, I mean, there's paved roads leading in and out of Hardwick. I mean, I would say that most people there wouldn't want that. I mean,
yeah.
Even though, you know, I think they feel like there are economic challenges, a lot of people choose to be there for all the things that aren't there, if you know what I'm saying.
Exactly.
They like the quiet nature of it, and they would not actually choose that anyway.
Yeah, well, all our towns were, like you say, around 30,000 population before you got to, well, that was a city to us, maybe.
Right, exactly.
40,
yeah.
50 years ago, and, you know, our area where we are in southern Ontario is probably very different from where you are in North Vermont. You have a lot of hills and mountains, I imagine.
That's correct, yes.
And so it makes, you know, the landscape makes a big difference in how many developers get to build suburbs and build freeways to get to those suburbs. So in here,
right,
we're being literally overrun by developers. They're taking farmland, saying it's dead. Now, I'm glad that you said that the farmland that you had, it wasn't really dead, but it was almost dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to be revitalized, brought back to life. And that's a trick that developers here have been waiting for and leaning on, or farmers that are about retirement age and don't, you know, they want to sell the farm off and they don't want to miss their only opportunity for retirement funds. So they
exactly.
say the soil's no good. And, I mean, to my mind, that's never really true, because the soil never really dies. You
right,
can always
right.
bring it back.
Yeah, right.
It's just, do you want to bring it back? And that's the situation I think we're facing here in Hamilton,
sure.
Where we are. So you've explained why you went to Hardwick, and you didn't want to write the book around your other town that's closer, Cabot. So what was the reason for that?
Well, Hardwick is just, they're frankly, I mean, Cabot's a much smaller town.
Okay.
And does not have as much, even though there are a lot of small-scale dairy farms in the town of Cabot. What's going on at Hardwick is pretty unusual, because there is a lot of collaboration amongst members of the small-scale ag-based businesses, and most of these businesses are sort of centered around sort of non-traditional forms of agriculture, at least non-traditional for Vermont. So, you know, one of the main businesses is a seed production business,
right.
And there's a soy milk and tofu production business. There is a very high-end cheese business. So, you know, what's going on in Hardwick is pretty unique, and I think also sort of indicative of kind of the cutting edge of small-scale agriculture and food systems in this country.
It's a perfect setting. But did these people that do these sorts of businesses come to Hardwick, or were they already there and said, okay, I'm going to start doing this now?
It's about half and half. Some of them were already in Hardwick. Some of them did come in or had some history there and came back to it, or, you know, had family there and came from somewhere else. So it's about half and half, I would say.
Okay, so a lot of people thinking alike in the right direction type of town.
That's right, and they're all fairly young. You know, there's a lot of 30-something people who are, you know, to my mind, sort of probably the face of what, you know, the next generation of agriculture is going to look like.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's great. So you had this perfect opportunity to tell everybody else how it's done.
Yeah, well, I don't. I would be remiss for me to say that I know exactly how it should happen. But you know, I did see this as an opportunity to at least present one town's story anyway in this regard. Yeah.
Right. And before we touch on that and the book itself, this is a situation that you couldn't apply or write the same book about if it was another town or maybe another type of terrain.
I don't necessarily know that. I mean, it clearly would be a different book with different characters. And I think any community is going to bring its own particular sort of strengths and or weaknesses to the story. So there may be I don't think this particular model of what's going on in Hardwick. I mean, I think, you know, a local food system is something that can be implemented really in any town. But of course, what the particulars of that are going to, what it's really going to look like, the nuts and bolts of it, are going to be very dependent on the ecosystem, on the people involved, and you know, their intellectual property, what they can bring to the system, on the community itself, what its level of support is going to be. When I started writing this book, not aware of any other town that had probably developed as functional a localized food system as Hardwick. There are a lot of towns that are and communities that are working toward that, but I would still argue that Hardwick is probably as far along that path as any community that I've seen.
Right, because I have done some research and talked to other people who have gone off-grid and trying to take their towns in the direction that Hardwick's going. So we're looking
right
at this. So you're coming to Hamilton to give us a speech or a talk on this book. And one of the reasons we're looking at having people like you come to Hamilton and give talks that, you know, discuss maybe some of the things that they don't know about is mm-hmm. because we are trying to do what Hardwick is doing. And
sure.
We have Hamilton is a small city, and it's 50 miles away from Toronto, so it's really undercut for a lot of businesses because Toronto has a, you know, you can't build this or do this business because
right.
we're so close to you know. So it doesn't have the opportunity with business as much as it used to. It used to be a steelmaking town, and that's basically mm-hmm. been undermined. But all around Hamilton were small towns. Grimsby, Dundas, Winona, they grew fruit. They were dairy farms. But they were all amalgamated. When we had Mike Harris come in as our provincial premier, they all amalgamated. So now all these towns were working with rules based on the city of Hamilton. And
right.
it's not working very well. So they're trying to get back to what they were before.
Trying
to get back to being a small town.
I mean, it sounds like Hamilton has a lot in common with Hardwick in the sense that it was a sort of an industrial center, and now, that industry has sort of faded and is trying to figure out a way to sort of get on its feet and create a sort of more durable form of economic opportunity.
Yeah, they have to. And a lot of cities are going to have to. So now let's get to what the town did.
Yeah, so what's going on in the town? I mean, I think, you know, no pun intended, but, you know, a lot of this stuff sort of happened organically. I mean, I think what happened was that it probably, you know, I think I mentioned like 5 or 6 years ago, there were all of these businesses that were sort of popping up because of these other factors. You know, the fact that there was this sort of history of agriculture in the area, the fact that there was available land and available property at a reasonable price. And a few of these business owners, I think, started looking around
right.
at each other and sort of noticing that they had something kind of interesting going on with all this activity and sort of looking at ways that they could start to work more collaboratively to sort of benefit from each other's strengths.
Right.
And so that's, I think, one of the things that's kind of unique about what's going on in Hardwick is that there is a level of collaboration that is pretty unusual. And so a lot of these businesses, and part of this is just, you know, there's opportunity because there are so many businesses, but they will share delivery trucks. Or if somebody's going, you know, if somebody needs to take a load of lettuce over here, they'll call up, you know, another business and see if maybe they have a truck going that way. They do an informal business owners. They have an informal business owners group where they get together to discuss confidentially problems that any of these individual companies might be having, and they often loan each other money. So this is, you know, one of the big issues with sort of fomenting these systems is that, you know, not only are we working against an industrial food system, but we're also working against an industrial money system.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's often hard to find the economic resources to make a go of it in small-scale agriculture.
Yeah, I think you just hit on two of the keys, or three keys, is they were consciously thinking about survival of the town as a unit. They collaborated, as you said, they shared, you know, if somebody didn't have something, they shared it. In fact, I'm a little long in the tooth now, I'm 60. And I came from one of those small town communities, and we lived on a small fruit farm. But I remember my father back then, that's how they got along. You know,
sure.
One had
a
truck that would spray, and so he would trade off picking for spraying and that sort of thing. They wouldn't have survived without it.
Right, and I think, you know, we've gotten away from that in part because, you know, we sort of had the, I guess, sort of, you know, I say this a little bit sarcastically, but a little bit we've had the luxury of getting away from it because we've had abundant, cheap energy. We've had an economy that seems to be able to support at least, you know, well enough, you know, these communities from afar with technology. But I think, you know, anyone who's sort of paying attention to the larger sort of trends in the world and the direction things are going, I think is realizing that it's not always going to be this way and that we need to figure out ways for our small communities to create, you know, sort of more durable economies, local, relocalized economies. So right. We have to start thinking more collaboratively and more systematically. I mean, it used to be, you know, people came together out of necessity, and they came together to get the hay in or just like you're saying, whatever, you know, they came together collaboratively because that's the way it happened. And we've gotten away from that, and now we have to sort of figure out how to get back to that, I think.
Well, we lost social trends by the fact that we could be alone in our car, alone in our thoughts, isolate ourselves from nature, isolate ourselves from what the air really smells like when you're not driving your car.
Yeah.
This isolation is, for teenagers and young people, it was really ideal, right? It was their first coming of age and being able to be independent and run away from mommy and daddy because you had a tool to take off.
Right.
And our whole economy has been built on that.
It has. And it's very extractive. I mean, it's very, very damaging to our small communities because it extracts wealth from those communities or resources from those communities. I mean, you know, I guess when I say wealth, I'm not thinking of just money. I'm thinking of other forms of wealth. And I think that's one of the great potentials of small-scale agriculture, localized agriculture. I mean, you know, we clearly need to relocalize our communities. Agriculture is not the only thing that we should be looking at as sort of a leverage point to do this, but it is the one that makes, I would argue, probably the most sense.
It's the most drastically needed right now.
It's the most drastically needed. I think it's got the most potential. And in you know, no small part because it's something that we know how to do. I mean, most of us as 21st century North Americans don't really know how to produce for ourselves the things that we use on a day-in, day-out basis. I don't know how to make a car. I don't know how to make a computer. All these things that I rely on, I don't really know how to create. I do know how to grow food. And anybody can learn how to grow food.
I'm going to argue that point a little bit.
Sure.
I was talking to the producer and director of End of Suburbia.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that film, but when it first came out.
I did see it years ago, yeah.
Right, and when it first came out, the radio show, of course, it works out of McMaster University here, so I brought them in for a talk after the show, and the one fellow, he was kind of still shocked and stunned even after he saw the film and has been living with the film for about a year before it was out. And he said, I came from a small dairy farm in Paris, Ontario. He said, I don't remember how to milk a cow. I don't remember how to do this.
Right.
I can go to a store and just for exchange of money, I get my cheese and my eggs and my milk.
Sure.
And he looked like the deer in the headlights.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that he could learn how to milk a cow in a, you know, give him a couple days. He'll learn how to milk a cow. He's not probably going to learn. And, of course, there are exceptions to all of, to, you know, I'm generalizing here. But it's not probably that realistic to think that our local communities are going to learn how to make the computers or the cars that they need, you know, which I would argue really are not necessarily part of a truly durable future. But, you know, the point I'm trying to make is that I think it's really disempowering to have created an economy and a culture where most of the things that we need to get through our days are things that are produced very, very, very far away.
Well, I think that's done purposefully. I mean,
that could be.
We've got so much poverty now, and we have so many billionaires that run global corporations. That's what's bought out Hamilton. They came in and totally bought out the steel, and then they shut the gates to the local workers and bust in cheaper workers. And we got in our grocery store, we started to see a lot of produce coming in from Chile. Things that weren't in season for us anymore, coming in from Chile and other parts like that, because they came via a plane, a truck, a train or something.
Right.
And up north of North America, right up the middle of North America, these type of thinkers are building these football field highways.
Uh-huh.
It divides America right in half.
Sure,
it's fenced for security. But it's that's their alternative to what's coming. They're taking care of themselves by locking themselves away from everything else, but they've got the conduit and the access to the food that you need because they took the farmland away from you, and so what are you going to do? So we've got an economy. A lot of people don't want to, some people, they're calling the shots and helping the politicians get elected. You know, because they got the money. They don't want to change us back to being able to take care of ourselves.
No, I mean, it's very much, you know, it's a system that consolidates power, money, in the hands of a very, very few. There's no question about that. And if you are among those very, very few, you're not really very highly motivated to try and work for change.
Exactly. If you're not motivated, you don't care about the numbers of poverty. It doesn't occur to you that they're growing by the thousands.
Right.
All you're looking at is the stock market. We have
That's
a society that is being run by the stock market.
Yeah.
I mean, Canada, we just recently merged our stock market with the United Kingdom. So there you go. There's the European Union joining together. What is the point of that? Well, somebody's thinking about, you know, a global economy. We've got such a global economy, it can't sustain itself.
No,
it's going to crash very soon, and people will be in a lot of trouble.
And it becomes, you know, the more globalized it becomes, the less resilient it becomes. So there's more interconnectedness and more, you know, more dependence on other systems. And so once, you know, if one of those systems fails, then the whole thing comes down.
Exactly.
So,
because they can,
you know, and the sort of the flip side of that is that I think, you know, we do need interconnectedness and interdependence on a human scale. I mean, that's one of the reasons I think what's going on in Hardwick works, is because there is that sense of community and people willing to sort of rely on each other. But when it comes, you know, when you have that operating on a sort of a systems level, a globalized systems level, it becomes very, very vulnerable and fragile.
Yeah, and the handful of rich don't care because they say, I've got enough money to protect myself.
Right.
So the hell with everybody else. As long as it's okay for me. But what they don't realize is that bad air is going to affect everybody, and climate change is going to affect everybody. You can't insulate yourself from growing temperatures. It's impossible. So sooner or later, they're going to come to the same reality that a lot of the people down the pecking scale already know.
Yeah.
So one of the questions I wanted to ask you is about preserving it. That's one of the concerns people up here have had questions about. They're having little gardens all the way around the place for vegetables, and it's a little more difficult for fruit trees, but preserving those vegetables. Nobody has a fruit cellar anymore, it seems.
Or is that right?
No, not when you're living in a city with apartment buildings.
Yeah, so, of course, You know, it's interesting to come into, you know, urban environments and talk about this stuff because, you know, people do raise questions like that. And it's like, you know, I live in a rural community where people have always been basically putting up their own food and never really went away to a certain extent. And so everyone, you know, just about everyone we know has a root cellar. And, you know, one of the things people ask me a lot is, what are elements from, you know, Hardwick or from this version of agriculture that you sort of live amongst that, you know, that we can sort of borrow and take from this, even though that we are in an urban environment. And I think, you know, that's you bring up a really good point, which is that some of this infrastructure just simply, you know, there are elements of the infrastructure that's being developed in Hardwick or in other small communities that I think can really be exported, even though the entire model doesn't work. But like you're talking about, I think some of the most valuable things that can happen for a community, whether it's an urban or a rural community, are actually, you know, quite wonderfully some of the easiest and least expensive things, such as community root cellars or community greenhouses. I mean, that's one thing that's been talked about in Hardwick, is creating community greenhouses where people can start their own seedlings in the spring. For instance, because not, you know, it's not that realistic for everybody to have their own greenhouse, but a lot of people might want to have a garden in their backyard but not have a good way to start their plants. So there are sort of low-cost, low-input ways to sort of, you know, foster this kind of stuff. I sort of call them the enabling factors, and they're not necessarily businesses that are going to create jobs and economic activity, but they do enable people at a very sort of grassroots level to become involved.
When you said there's no job creation, I bet you, thinking and speaking just of an urban community full of apartment buildings, full of people living in poverty, packed full of people whose jobs have recently been taken out from under them, and food prices have gone up at the local grocery store.
Right.
I don't know what percentage, but a couple of years ago or 3 years ago or less, apples were like 29 cents to 49 cents a pound, and now
right.
they're up to $1.49 a pound. You know, they're going up that fast, and that's apples, but they're
right.
coming from China.
Right.
And I'm thinking, we grow apples here. How do we store them for the extra few months? It's that
right.
cycle of growing, storing, preserving in an urban environment. You know, I cannot make the owner of my apartment building put food on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Or grow vertical gardens. He just doesn't care about it. He's got about 20 different locations and buildings.
Right.
It doesn't enter his mind, doesn't bother him, doesn't affect him directly. Therefore, why should he listen to me?
Sure, right.
Make the suggestion, you know?
Yeah.
So you got any thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, it sort of depends on any community's particular resources. I don't know. I know, for instance, I was in Seattle earlier, actually almost a year ago now, I guess about 9 months ago, and I was actually amazed at some of the things that have been accomplished in Seattle with, sort of urban crop vegetable farming on open space land that had been converted. And also they have an organization that right in the center of the city, that's on about a half an acre of land, maybe even a little less, where they have created, I can't remember exactly, I think it was 50 small garden plots that people are able to use. So, you know, there are ways around it, finding sort of, you know, the key is, of course, having someone who either has access to a piece of property or owns a space where they're willing to sort of give over to this kind of activity.
Yeah, we've got a lot of that starting here. It's slow, but it's starting, and it costs money right now, money
sure,
that the poor can't
yeah.
afford, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, and that's why, you know, one of the root problems here, you know, it's really common to talk about, you know, the industrial agriculture system and all, you know, everything that it's, you know, all the problems with that and why, you know, how hard it is to make small-scale agriculture work in the face of industrial agriculture. And that's definitely true. But I think the other big problem is sort of a term I mentioned this a few minutes ago, which is we also have an industrial money system. And we don't have, you know, our economies, our localized economies are all by necessity tied to this larger sort of globalized economy. And, you know, just as we need to figure out how to sort of detether from the industrial agriculture system, we also, I think, need to figure out how to detach and how to separate from the industrial money system. And that's, you know, arguably, I would say, almost the greater challenge.
Yes, and I personally think the biggest challenge, which is even worse than being addicted to tobacco, is being addicted to having your own car.
Right, yeah, I agree with that.
The commercials are there shoving it at you every night at prime time.
Right. Yeah, well, it's one of the great ironies of the way we live. I mean, we live out in the country, and we have this wonderful little farm. We produce, you know, 80% of our own food, and everyone says, "Oh, you're totally self-sufficient." But you know, the reality is, we drive a lot, and I wish I could say it was different, but it's not. You know, and that's something that, you know, is going to change. It will change by necessity, but it's going to mean a very, very, very different lifestyle for us.
Well, that's a big problem here too. You have to have a car to go and get the food. They're
right.
trying to
yeah.
bring the food into the city from the country, but that involves bringing cars, you know, and trucks and bringing a stand to set it up in some alley.
Right, Yeah.
That's the biggest part of the equation that I think we're so addicted to that we'll continue to allow roads to be built so we can drive on those roads.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll continue to pave over
mm-hmm.
possible places to feed this city alone. It's the making the awareness problem.
Right.
Because
yeah.
they're so isolated and they haven't been physically or personally affected by it yet. They've got enough money to pay for the increases of food at the market. So they don't care. The masses
right.
haven't got it yet. They don't feel
yeah.
it yet.
No, I agree with you.
How do you deal with that mindset when it's like a different world?
Yeah, one thing is that, like, I'm not faced with that mindset on a real regular basis because I live in this rural area. But I am always struck, I travel, really more than I want to be totally honest, but I do travel for my work and end up, flying into communities. And I'm always just so incredibly struck when I fly into urban centers, typically just in the U.S., and just, how it is a really different mindset and people, I think, sometimes it's really easy for me to believe that everyone has a certain awareness because I live in this sort of microcosm, and that's just clearly not the case. I think there's a lot of awareness still to be earned out there, and there's a ways to go. But the flip side of that is, as challenging as that is, I also think it points at how much potential there is. I mean, it's like, we are just really scratching the surface, and if we can get people to make really conscientious decisions and choices about how they consume, how they live their lives, there's a tremendous amount of low-hanging fruit, no pun intended, but a lot of low-hanging fruit that can really, really move us in the right direction.
What do you mean by low-hanging fruit?
I mean things that we can do that are not that hard. There's a lot of things to be done that are like, here's an example. I don't know what the numbers are like up there at all, but in the U.S. they say that the average American spends about 9% of his or her income feeding themselves over the course of a year. Now, of course, that doesn't include all the externalized costs like healthcare, agricultural subsidies that are paid through taxes. That's just how much money they spend at the grocery store. Okay,
9%.
9%. Okay, so for a family, let's say your family is making $50,000 a year, that's $4,500 a year, okay? Now, in Vermont, which is, in terms of sales from consumer to food producer, is the best state in the union. There are more direct sales from food producer to consumer in Vermont than any other state in America. The average amount that a Vermonter spends directly to a food producer is $35. So out of $4,500 for that sort of mythical family of four on, living on $50,000 that spends 49% of their income on food in a year, only $35, less than 1%, is getting spent on local food. And so one way to look at that is like, wow, that's really discouraging because that's not very much, right? But another way to look at that is to think about how much potential there is for an improvement in supporting our small-scale agriculture producers if people would commit to just spending, maybe instead of 35, what if they spent 70, right?
Well, I think it's...
That's not very much.
If you take different cities, it's going to be a different equation for every place.
Oh, sure, of course. I'm just talking about what the numbers are, the numbers that I know, and the numbers I know are here. But I also happen to know, in the U.S. at least, Vermont at $35 per person is three times better, or spends three times more. I shouldn't say better. I don't want to quantify it that way, but spends three times more than the state that the next state, which is Maine. So there's a lot of there's so much improvement to be made. The only point I'm trying to make is that there's a lot of in every state in the union, including Vermont, there's a lot of room for improvement and there's a lot of potential.
Okay, and the other factor that has to go with food, we haven't even talked about fertilization of ground and soil and water.
Right. Is water? Yeah, we are fortunate to live in an area where water access is not an issue. We live in a very fertile and rich wet environment, but that, clearly in other parts of North America there are huge water sourcing issues.
Right. And can you tell me about soil issues? Because you said a lot of the soil in your state or area is kind of dead soil.
Well, I don't want to say it's dead soil at all. All I'm saying is that most of the soils in North America
depleted.
Have been used and need some help. What's that?
Let's use the term depleted because
they're all depleted. That's correct. They're depleted and to varying degrees. It's not as if they can't be used productively. It's just that they could be used. They could be more productive if they were given a little help. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so we're sitting in a city like Hamilton, where you're coming to talk to people who already know about what you're doing and what you're writing in your book. I mean, it's like preaching to the converted, when I go to these meetings at night, I hardly ever see the masses in my city that need
right.
to be at that meeting. I never see enough news coverage about the talk before or after
mm-hmm.
that gives me enough information or impetus to want
right.
to say, that guy's totally right. I should
mm-hmm.
stop driving 50 miles to work.
Mm-hmm.
I should see about turning my lawn into something like a garden. They
right.
don't do that. They won't
yeah.
do that.
Yeah.
So
well,
those are the ones that we have to convert. And what will happen is it's going to be all of a sudden your method of living stops. There's
right,
no oil.
Right.
That's it. Game over. And we're going to have masses of people that cannot feed themselves. So I wonder, how do we deal with that possibility that's coming down the pipes at us?
Well, I don't. That's a good and hard question. I think that the reality is, you're never going to convince everybody, and that all you can do is keep chipping away and hope to at some point achieve some kind of critical mass. I will say that one of the things that I have found most helpful when I'm talking about these issues is to talk about the economic potential inherent to sort of relocalizing these economies, and particularly
Good.
Around food. And I think the reason is that's what I call sort of, it's an issue that appeals to most corners of the political spectrum. So it doesn't matter if you're a liberal or a conservative, or a libertarian, you can sort of understand that there's value in creating economic opportunity in communities that doesn't have to be outsourced to far away. And so we know, for instance, there have been studies in Europe done. And I'll bring this back to food a little bit. There's been studies in Europe that show that if you go and spend a dollar in your supermarket on, food from, Chile or California or wherever, from far away, basically, without thinking about where it comes from, about 20 cents out of that dollar is going to stay in your community. If you go to your farmer's market and you hand a dollar to a farmer and he hands you back, whatever you're buying, tomatoes or lettuce, about 65 cents of that dollar is going to stay in your community. And so, if we can talk about this sometimes in economic terms, there are all sorts of reasons, of course, to be moving toward localized food systems. They're more healthy, they're restorative to our communities and our soils, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is, I think that one of the ways to reach the most people and people who are not already converted is through the issue of economics.
Right. I like the idea of creating future jobs with the
mm-hmm.
solar,
right.
with the wind power.
Yep.
People are thinking that kind of stuff to get off the grid, but they're
That's
not
right.
thinking about getting themselves out of their car yet.
Right. No, they're not. And that's a little bit much of a leap for a country. I'm talking about the U.S., but I think Canada is probably the same way, that is as sort of wedded to their automobiles as we are. And, we'll see. Are we really going to be able to do that without some kind of crisis? I honestly don't know. I would like to say, yes, there's a way to make that happen. But I think time will tell whether or not we're able to get ourselves to make those movements in a sort of proactive way. I don't know.
Now, I do know there are a lot of people in Hamilton that are aware and are making some changes. And one of the
Sure.
things our local city hall finally decided to do is, I call it yuppie-izing the basics. Like if there's a park that's raw and it's full of weeds and lots of trees and only a few people know about it, and it's got rabbits living in it and deers living in it,
Yep.
the city looks at that and thinks, let's fix it up. Let's turn it into a place where people want to come.
Right.
And
yeah.
they yuppie-ize it.
Yeah.
They groom it. Everything's immaculate. You have
mm-hmm.
bike trails and walking trails. You take most of the nature out of it, most of the reason people went to the woods out of it.
Right. Right.
And
yeah.
You know, and they're sort of done that with our farmers market. I know I'm going to get in trouble for saying that, but we just now opened our brand new farmers market. Cost a lot of money for the city, and it boggles my mind. And I'm not really sure how much the money is. I'll have to check that
out. Right.
But it cost the city and the taxpayers a lot of money to make our farmers market that's been there for hundreds of years become yuppie-ized. You know,
you have
chefs in there now showing you how you can cut food and cook food, and everything looks beautiful.
Right.
You know, it looks like something you would see on TV, and there's nothing really wrong with that. I mean, it's a good idea. It takes people like you and I are discussing, the people that ride their cars, gives them a reason to want to go to the farmer's market, you know, because there's no scruffy-looking people hanging around, and that looks neater and cleaner, you know. And so that's a very good thing. But in another way, they've stolen part of the soul.
Sure, yeah, no, that's a challenge, I think, with any of this stuff. There's no question about it.
We talked about soil and we talked about water. So let's talk a little bit about what you want to say when you come here with the book so people will want to buy it.
What are they going to learn? Well, you know, I mean, a lot of this, and I will have a conversation with, I think it's Karen, who actually originally asked me to come up there, but I always have a conversation with whomever has asked me to come speak about what it is they most want to hear about. So let me ask you, what do people in Hamilton most want to hear?
Well, I wouldn't be the one to ask because Karen is the one that brought you, but I would like them to say, get out of their car and grow local.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, I generally start by telling a little bit of the story of Hardwick because it gives us a little bit of a reference point and a place to start. And, you know, I think one of the things that's really interesting about this story and about this town is that it is, and particularly perhaps in relation to Hamilton, is that it is a town with a similar history. It sounds like it's obviously a smaller town, but its history is very similar. And, you know, its people are rallying, the local population is rallying around what's going on right now, and I think that, you know, I will certainly want to talk a lot about the potential, some of the things that we've been talking about today, which is that, you know, this type of localized agriculture system is, I think, holds perhaps the greatest potential for communities to recognize some kind of more durable economic future. I think that, you know, when they are working, and there are all sorts of different factors to consider, but the real potential is for a system that is somewhat self-contained, that is supported by the communities, and therefore is incredibly durable, and not so subject to the whims of the global economy.
So we've been speaking with Ben Hewitt from Vermont, and he's the writer of the recent book, The Town That Food Saved. I think that's a very interesting title. Thanks very much for your time today, Ben.
Thank you, Megan. I really appreciate it.
I look forward to meeting you. Ben's in Hamilton, February the 23rd. I'll take Ben's word for that.
If you find out I'm wrong, please let me know because I got to change my ticket.
Well, no, you're probably right. I'm usually the one that's off. So thanks very much, Ben. I'll let you go.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.